I think this passage might be hard for some in this community here, and so I hope that you'll bear patiently with the text, because we're just going through this chapter by chapter, and this happens to be the chapter we're at. We're at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and Paul's now going to give the most extended discussion there is on marriage. This is it. It's very interesting to me. I have been pastoring for 26 years. I've probably done 150 plus weddings. I've helped that many people prepare a wedding. Part of planning a wedding is what verses are you going to use and read when it comes time to read in the service. And what you find, the dirty little secret that most pastors know but most parishioners don't, is there's not a lot of passages specifically about marriage. That's why, at a marriage, here's the passage you hear read more than anything. 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter, even though it's not about marital love at all, it's between 1 Corinthians 11 and 13, which is about spiritual gifts. It's about life in the church. It's not about marital love at all. You can apply it to that, but that's not what it's about. Other people looking for passage will use Colossians 3 that talks about living in humility and putting on that belt of love, but that's not about marriage. It's about living the new life in Christ. Others will use, and I think, you guys might have used this, because you have to use some passage. Two are better than one. A cord of three strands will not be broken, from Ecclesiastes. Well, that's a great verse, but it's not about marriage. It's about friendship. It's about community. It's about giving yourself to others so you can be bonded together and battle things together more strongly. You can apply it to marriage, but it's not about marriage. The best verses, if you're going to use any verses about marriage, with the exception of 1 Corinthians 7, is Song of Songs. But it's so steamy and erotic, most people don't want to use that at their wedding, because it's all about the heat of the moment. It's about passion. In fact, you look almost in vain to find any sense of marital commitment there. It's all about the sex in Song of Songs. So, when you're putting together marriage ceremonies, you realize after doing this 100-plus times, there's not a lot of specific teaching. Now, some will say, well, there's not a lot of specific teaching, but we can go to examples. We can go to Abraham, or we can go to Isaac, or we can go to Jacob, or we can go to David. Okay, let's do that. Abraham lies twice. His wife ends up in another person's house. David, who has dozens of wives. Jacob, who has four wives who fight over, you know, who's going to give him the best child. Solomon, who has hundreds of wives. Moses, whose wife Zipporah wants to kill him because he won't circumcise the child at the right time. And what you find, even though we have a lot of marriages in the Bible, what happens there is descriptive. It's not prescriptive. We're not getting examples for marital life from Moses or Abraham or any others. We're getting descriptions of what they're going through. So here's the dirty little secret. There's very few passages specifically about marriage, even though some in the church want to make that what the whole thing's about. That's what Christianity is about. It's about family life. It's about marriage. You struggle in vain to find specific passages, with the exception of 1 Corinthians 7. But this passage is largely ignored. In fact, you know, the lectionary readings that we've gone through all of this year, where in the cycle of 3 years, you can go through what the church pronounces that churches ought to go through over 3 years. If you attend a church all your life and you hear all the lectionary readings every year, you will never ever touch 1 Corinthians 7. The church, global, has decided you don't need this passage. You know why they've decided that? Because the old view on this passage was that Paul's really not speaking about marriage in a positive way. He has kind of a scummy, self-interested, low view of marriage. He doesn't get the love and the mutual commitment and children and family. He just wants to talk about sex. So Paul can never win, you know. Paul has his haters, and he always will have his haters, because even when he talks about things like normative sexual relationships in a marriage, people will turn him off because they say, but you're not saying anything about kids. You're not saying anything about sitting in front of the fireplace holding hands and being, you know, staring in each other's eyes. What's your problem, Paul? What's your problem? Why do you have such a disgustingly low view on marriage? Well, here's what's interesting. That used to be the view. The view's changed over the last 30 or 40 years. But if you go back to the 70s or 80s, you'll find this is a very common perception of the passage we're about to study. Gunther Bornheim, he was a great German theologian, he writes of 1 Corinthians 7, "I deplore the lack of any positive appreciation of the love between the sexes or of the richness of human experience in marriage and family in this passage." Well, let's read what he's talking about here, just so you can see what he's actually commenting on. 1 Corinthians 7, page 169 in the Pew Bible. I certainly hope that you'll have that open or your own Bible before you. That'll help you to follow as we discuss this passage. "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is well for a man not to touch a woman. But because of cases of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman should have her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a set time, to devote yourselves to prayer and then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This I say by way of concession, not of command. I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has a particular gift from God, one having one kind and another a different kind." Now go back to the first verse, because we want to talk about this passage. The old school way of thinking about this was the Bornheim view. The way I'm going to approach it is the way that more contemporary modern theologians look at it, in saying, you know, Paul has an incredibly progressive and beautiful picture of mutual submission, of giving and receiving, of commitment to one another and regularly loving one another and showing that love that goes leaps and bounds beyond his native culture. This is not what people in his day are writing. He, and that's why I use the word progressive, he's way past what the dominant voices in his culture are saying about marriage. So to assume off the cuff that this is Paul just giving a horrifically, horribly low view of marriage is to not give him a fair reading. And what I hope tonight to do is to give him that fair reading. And the fair reading begins by understanding what Paul's doing. Look at verse 1. "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote," which is to say, Paul is never intending to give a full-orbed view of family and marriage. He's answering questions. He's finally at the point in his letter, he's been talking about other things that he's heard, reports from Chloe and other terrible things happening in the Corinthian church, problems he's already addressed, but now he's responding to a letter they've written to him, and he's answering the questions that they've posed to him. And so in answering those questions, we kind of have to be on one end of the telephone line and ask ourselves, well, what are those questions? Well, one of those questions must have been, what about marriage? What about marital relations? Are marital relations holy? Can they be? What about divorce? He'll move on and talk about divorce. What about people who are betrothed to be married? What about fiancés and other such things? So here we're dealing with the initial question, but here's what's interesting about that first verse. "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is well or good for a man not to touch a woman." You stop there, and of course you can proclaim that Paul has a horrifically low view of marriage. But do you remember 1 Corinthians chapter 6, just preceding this? In fact, verse 12, "All things are lawful for me, but not all things are beneficial." Do you recall, church, when we looked at that 4 weeks ago, what's going on there? That Paul's giving quotes that the Corinthians are espousing, and then he's adding his own perspective to it because the quote is not the whole truth. Well, that's what this is, and our translation recognizes that. You'll notice in quotation, "It is well for a man not to touch a woman," and that's the issue. Touch is a euphemism for sexual relationships, and what you realize is Paul's quoting them. He's quoting the people that have written them. And they have said, "Hey, Paul, you know, help us out with marriage, because we all know it's good for a man not to touch a woman. We all know that this sexual union thing in marriage can't ever lead to holiness. It can't be a positive thing. It can't be good. We know it's good for a man not to touch a woman." Paul's addressing a slogan that he's not going to add to, because you can't add to this. It is completely and utterly wrong. He has to completely take them and put them in a place where they understand what they've written is absolutely not true at all. Now, why would some in the Corinthian church actually believe this? It's good not to have marital relationships within a marriage. And the answer is pretty easy. We've talked about this in 1 Corinthians, and we can talk about it anytime we touch the New Testament in particular. The dominant Greco-Roman view of the body was that the body was a prison house for the soul. That the soul's what matters, the body's just a cage, the body's irrelevant. And when you believe that the body's a prison house for the soul, you lead to one of two extremes. We've already seen the one extreme. If you believe it's just a prison house for the soul, you indulge it. Anything goes, what's done in the body doesn't matter. That's 1 Corinthians 5 and 6. Do you recall? The people were going to visit prostitutes. It doesn't matter. It's just my body. It doesn't touch my spirit. It doesn't touch my soul. Paul's already addressed that abuse, that extreme of seeing the body as simply a prison house for the soul. But there's another extreme you can go to, and that is the extreme of asceticism, seeking to pacify the body. Because since the body is evil and nothing holy can ever come from the body, you have to curb and to deny it in order to be truly spiritual. You've got to repress the body and make sure nothing that has to do with bodily pleasure, bodily engagement, gets in the way of true holiness. That's the issue he's dealing with here. And obviously some in the Corinthian community had concluded that sex was part of fleshly human experience. And because it was fleshly, it was unspiritual. And they believed in order to really be holy in soul, they must renounce the body. And so their conclusion was truly spiritual people avoid sex altogether, even if they're in a committed relationship. That's why Paul wants to use that slogan and then not expand upon it, but completely upend it and say, you know, there's no truth to this at all. We need to really develop what this means. And he does this in a wonderful way. Verse 2, but because of cases of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman should have her own husband. He's already talked about some of the people that indulge and are actually destroying their lives and other people's commitments through their indulgence. And he's aware that that temptation's always there. And so he says this, and this is what's fascinating. Verse 3, the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights and likewise the wife to her husband. So far, nothing groundbreaking. Here's what becomes utterly groundbreaking. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Again, nothing groundbreaking in a patriarchal culture. Nothing groundbreaking. You want to know what's completely unexpected? What no one else is saying in his culture? The next phrase. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. What? Hold on. The man's in charge. The man has authority. The man can exercise his rights. What's this about women's rights here? What kind of crazy world are we in now? Well, guess what? Long before women's rights, Paul's an advocate. This is why I'm always troubled by people that want to just get rid of Paul as if he's just this grumpy, old, you know, withered, angry man. He's going way, he's the progressive of his day. He's going way beyond what anyone's saying when he says, you know what? There shouldn't be a hierarchy in marriage. There ought to be mutual submission. Each giving to the other what they owe them. Each giving of themselves to the other freely, for that's what they've committed to. There should be not a hierarchical relationship, not the husband being lord of his wife, but there should be a mutual and reciprocal relationship where each has a claim on the other. And if you want to see Paul go even further than that, he's actually assenting way ahead of his time that sexual intimacy should involve not just pleasure for the man, but mutual pleasure. It's for both. both should have a share in this. This is a gift. This is something that you've committed to. This is something that you share in. So that Paul is way ahead of his times in speaking of the marital relationship in a way that goes light years beyond what anyone in his contemporary society is saying. When he says each has rights over the others, he's throwing away all power plays, all sexual politics, all ideas of saying, you give me what I want and I'll sleep with you. But if you don't, well, then we'll see how things roll. There's no manipulation, there's no control. It's just a mutual receiving and giving as an expression of love. It's also not a dominating over another and misusing that right you have to the other person. I like what Gordon Fee says. He says, the idea is not that you owe me, but I owe you. I'm to give you what is yours. And the fact is, I'm yours. I've given myself to you. You've given yourself to me. It is actually going all the way back to Song of Songs. If you ever study Song of Songs, and we did, what, 8, 7 some years ago, somewhere back then, there's a progression in Song of Songs where the woman is speaking and she says, my beloved is mine and I am his. But by the end she says, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. She has this recognition that there's this mutual commitment and this sharing of belonging to one another, that each is for the other. And so far from misusing this or abusing this to get your way in a marriage, the idea is that both have rights, both have obligations. There should be a mutual reciprocal commitment to one another in regard to relationship, and that includes, in Paul's thinking, normal, healthy sexual relations, with one exception. But notice how he speaks of this exception. Verse 5. Do not deprive one another. Okay, so you could stop right there and say, don't deprive one another. So this is the norm, these mutual relationships, except perhaps by agreement, so it has to be mutual, for a set time, not forever, to devote yourselves to prayer and then come together again. You know why? So that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This I say by way of concession, not of command. So, you must understand, he's already established normal sexual relationships are healthy. That's how a marriage should look. There could be an exception, perhaps, but he doesn't command it. He says it is a concession, which is his way of saying, you know, you can fast from certain things for a time to devote yourself to spiritual matters, but you shouldn't fast forever. And the fact that you're fasting, for example, when you don't eat for a time to devote yourselves to prayer, and we do that for 3 days every year here at this church, well, I hope that that's not the only time you pray, right? I mean, it's a special occasion. You have a specific focus, and it's a set time. You know it by mutual agreement. We're not going to fast until one of us dies. There's a set time. So Paul's not in any way saying, hey, the only time you can really pray is when you're fasting from sex. Instead, he's saying, just like with any fast, you do it for a time. It must be mutual, but it's not even necessary. It's not commanded. It's a concession I'm making. And then he says, which is very important, he says it should only be a time because you need to watch out. You shouldn't overtax your partner. The end of verse 5, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. In other words, listen closely. Abstinence may bring them closer to God for a moment as they intend, but it may instead make them more vulnerable to temptation. So it might completely short-circuit the whole purpose of being devoted if they make it for too long a time where it's not set by mutual agreement. This is a very interesting passage. Well, he's going to end it. This I say by way of concession or command. And then he has an odd statement, which we're going to develop more next week. I wish that all were as I myself am. This is where Paul's going to begin to break into his discussion of his gift of celibacy. But he understands that he has a gift, and he assumes that not everybody does. In fact, he assumes that most people don't. So he says, but each has his own particular gift from God, one having one kind and another a different kind. Paul has a gift. It's interesting because next week we'll wrestle with the question, was Paul ever married? Was Paul a widow? Was he celibate all of his life? We'll wrestle with that because the next verse actually opens us up to that possible question. But for now, we just simply want to sit with the fact that Paul has given quite an interesting perspective on marriage and mutual submission and mutual respect and mutual commitment and love for another. And it's from these verses that I want to make, as I usually do, three reflections. The first one has to do with committed touch and how in Paul's mind it's good. Now, I'm using the word touch so as not to use the sex word, but I just used it. So that's what Paul's doing. He's using a euphemism. It is well for a man not to touch a woman. And I'm just simply saying married or committed touch is good. Now, what's interesting about Paul's teaching here is, as important as it is, it's going to be quickly overshadowed by the dominant voices in church history. Within 2 to 3 centuries, the normative teaching on sex, sexual relationships, even within marriage, is going to be this. John Chrysostom, all these people are from the 4th century. All these people, by the way, I have the highest respect for and a deep love for, but a full awareness that they are just as bound by their time and culture as I am. I'm going to make mistakes in what I say because I'm bound by my time and culture. There are things I'm blind to. It's just I can't see them now. Maybe 100 years from now, someone will see what I was blind to. I think as respectable and as devout as these writers and preachers and pastors were, they were blinded by a culture that had led them to at least have the influence of thinking the body's never really holy. Pleasure's never really good. It's always deceptive. It might lead you astray. It might lead you down the wrong path. So they had at least that overhanging everything they did. So John Chrysostom writes, virginity, or celibacy here, stands as far above marriage as the heavens stand above the earth. That's saying something. That's his promo for celibacy. It's better than anything. There's nothing like it. You'll never be holier than the virgin. The person who's never ever been defiled by sexual union. Jerome, he's the one who came up with the Latin Vulgate from which the Catholic Bible predominantly is usually translated from. All those who have not remained virgins following the pattern of the pure chastity of angels and that of our Lord Jesus Christ himself are polluted. Hi, polluted ones. You're polluted. I'm polluted. And you begin to see what's going on. What happened to Paul's teaching? Augustine, who has a major voice not only for Catholics, but also for Protestants. He maintained that marriage is not good, but it is good in comparison to fornication. So it's better than fornication. It's not good, but it's better than fornication. Which ain't saying much. For him, virginity was the angelic exercise. That's the reason why the traditional reading for the passage we're looking at tonight is that Paul grudgingly permits marriage as a distasteful concession to the lust of the flesh. That's how this used to be looked at. He's giving a concession to this distasteful lust of the flesh and saying, well, it's better than fornication. I don't think that's what he's saying. I hope I developed that enough that you see he's saying a lot more than that. That's not being fair to him. It's allowing the cultural milieu to move you and shape your understanding instead of hearing the progressive ear, the guy who's going way beyond the culture into the depths of understanding. And I think not because he's progressive moving forward, but he's progressive because he goes all the way back. God creates and it is good. The two become one. It is good. Song of Songs, it is good. He is refusing to let the culture diminish what he sees as essential. And then to top it all off, Jesus Christ, God becomes flesh. And when God becomes flesh, you can no longer say of the human body, it's a prison for the soul. You have to say it is the canvas upon which God's image shines. It is the instrument through which God's grace flows. which includes all those wonderful things like playing music and having sex and dancing and singing and all those bodily things, because God loves the body. God made it, after all, C.S. Lewis said. You know, God loves it. God made it. God chose to identify fully with it in the person of Christ. So Paul doesn't lament the physical aspect of marriage here. He instead encourages it. There's no trace that there's anything polluted about sexual relationships. But once you realize this, you begin to see, if you think that virginity is the holiest state to be, do you understand now, or at least a little better, why Catholics have a dogma of the perpetual virginity of Mary? That Mary not only gave birth to Jesus, but after that she remained perpetually a virgin. She never had intercourse with Joseph, even though if you read Matthew, immediately after the end of chapter 1, you realize that Jesus had siblings. Where'd they come from? Well, a Catholic will say, well, they were Joseph's prior. Well, no. The more accurate and more likely would be, you know, if Mary's going to be a good wife to Joseph, she ought to be having sex with him. Poor Joseph. If Mary decides, in view of the holiness that I will maintain, back off, Jack. You can see why this dogma arises. Now, that's not to say it's untrue. I don't know, but it certainly, I don't think, accords with scriptural revelation, and I think it has more in touch with Platonic idealism, the body being a prison for the soul, than it does with Hebraic goodness of humankind and of flesh and of body. So, that's Paul's first point. He wants to make sure that we see the committed touch is good. And that leads to a next reflection. Well, what is touch for? What's its purpose? And one of the reasons why some people get so angry about this passage is Paul mentions not a word about children. And yet, in Paul's day, his contemporaries, people writing alongside of him, who would have known, he would have known their writings at least, like Josephus, the law recognizes no sexual connections except the natural union of man and wife, and that only for procreation of children. Philo, who's writing as Paul's contemporary, when married partners have intercourse for pleasure instead of procreation, they are like pigs and goats. What is touch for? Well, Paul's made it clear by not mentioning children that the first and foremost reason for touch is children. He's made it that it's for the bonding of the relationship of the committed couple. He makes no mention of children because that's not the first and primary point. But again, once you see this, you can see why there's such a big hubbub in the Roman Catholic community that marital intercourse must be for procreation, so that if you're going to have marital relationships, you better not use birth control, because that stifles, that prohibits, that nullifies the purpose of the act in the first place. You must always be open to having children, or if you're not open to that, use natural family planning, because you can't use birth control, because this isn't a good thing if its purpose is simply for pleasure or for bonding. It must have, as the purpose, procreation. And I find it interesting, and you guys got to know, I love the Roman Catholic tradition. I love it deeply, profoundly. I think it has amazing things to offer us. I think it has its shortcomings, but I think the Protestant tradition has its shortcomings, and I'm part of that. So, you know, I'm being fair here. Paul never mentions procreation, but he strongly urges that there should be pleasure, that they should give of themselves to one another, that there's nothing wrong with committed relationships. He wants that to be understood very clearly. In fact, I think he throws out a warning by saying, hey, don't be in a committed relationship and not have this, because if you don't have this, you're opening the door for Satan. You're misjudging the human capacity for temptation, and you're thinking that you're making it easier. You're not. You're making it harder. Well, what's sex for? What's touch for? Well, it's not just for children. That's not the first and foremost point. And then finally, my last reflection. We've already covered this. I began by saying this, that many people want to look at this passage we're looking at and say, you know, Paul's so anti-marriage. Again, we go back to Bornham. I deplore the lack of any positive appreciation of the richness of human experience. I think Bornham's unfair. And I think anyone who takes his stance is unfair, because Paul's discussing the question that's been posed to him. If they had asked him, what about children? I think he would have written about children. If they'd asked him about family life, I think he would have written about family life. But that's not what they asked. They were asking about marital relationships, because there was at least a faction in the Corinthian community saying, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And he had to address that. He had to deal with the issue before him. And when you realize that, you realize we can't fault Paul for what he doesn't say, because he's not asked that question. We have to listen to what he does say. And what he does say is he gives a view of committed relationships that is such a beautiful vision of mutual, reciprocal, humble, self-giving, and receiving commitment and love, where I am my beloved's, my beloved is mine, where there is an owing to the other and the other gives in response, not where one lords it over the other, but there is a complete, mutual, reciprocal self-giving. Paul says this because he believes marriage is good. He believes it's the positive context for mutual self-giving and sharing of lives and sharing of sexual relationships. Paul believes with all his heart that the slogan they've given him is wrong. He is not going to force anyone to try to maintain that lofty ideal, because he knows anyone who tries to maintain it will fall to the passions of temptation and not end up being holy in body and spirit. They will instead fall. He wants the people that are married to know you can be holy in body and spirit and be totally and fully committed to one another in mutual, respectable submission. I think his picture is so bright. It's so beautiful. It's such a wonderful picture. I think it's actually such a beautiful picture. It's actually hard to attain to, because I think it's easier to do the power plays and the manipulation and the sex games. I think it's easier to do all that stuff. I think what he offers is a beautiful picture that comes as close as you can to the self-giving and receiving of Father, Son, and Spirit in the mutual delight and love of the three who are one.